from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, this year marks the 40th anniversary of America's all-volunteer military force. How did the elimination of the draft affect the military and U.S. society as a whole? And what is the impact of technology on modern warfare? And how will having women in combat change the armed forces? Those are some of the questions that will be examined in this hour ahead in his new book, The Modern American Military. Edited by Pulitzer Prize-winning Stanford historian David Kennedy, he takes all those up, and we will as well. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Stanford historian and Professor Emeritus David Kennedy, the 2000 Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, joins us in studio this Forum Hour to discuss his new edited book, The Modern American Military. Also formerly director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West, he is the author of the Pulitzer finalist Over Here, The First World War in American Society, as well as Birth Control in America, The Career of Margaret Sanger. And we're going to talk about the U.S. military with David Kennedy, who we welcome back to Forum, actually in the flesh here in studio. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
And I was just informed that Dave Iverson was a student of yours. We want that on record, with 15,000 others, but nevertheless, the fellow who hosts the Friday Forum program.
And he's among the most distinguished.
And he is indeed, I'm sure. And you are among our more distinguished guests. Glad to have you here. Volunteer Army, we should mention, started back in 1973, and I guess, as you said, this is neither your grandfather's army nor your father's army, and changes have been quantum. Let's get into them. I mean, one of the big questions you raise is where does civil duty and where does civil obligation go in terms of, you know, a volunteer army?
Well, I think that is one of the things that is ironically or unpredictably, given the origins of the all-volunteer force in 1973, that is most at risk is the relationship or the connection between civil society, put it more explicitly, the voters, the electorate, the citizens, and the armed force, which is sent into battle in their name. And that connection is now just, I think, worrisomely and dangerously thin. The military is a very small institution in scale relative to the size of our society. It's 0.5% of the population serves in the active duty military today. In the Vietnam era, that was well over 4%. In the World War II era, it was over 12%. And that – the last so-called good war is the one I think that's lodged so deeply in our popular memory and forms so many of our attitudes toward the military today. But the military we have today bears scant relationship in its size, the missions it's asked to undertake, the people who compose it, to the force that fought in World War II. So there are many things at risk, I think, in our traditional evaluation of the military in this situation. But the greatest and most serious and troubling of all is the matter of political accountability when the force is used.
Yeah, Andrew Bacevich, who's in your book, says it's no longer our army. It's a government-owned army. And I think you got yourself, a lot of reaction when you wrote in the New York Times that this is a mercenary army, I think was the language you used.
Yeah, I wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times several years back, and the lead sentence was that the United States now has what is in effect a mercenary army, which brought down a firestorm of criticism on my academic head. About a year ago, I was at the Aspen Institute, and I heard then recently retired chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, get up and say, "We now have a mercenary army," and he was applauded. So times have changed. We're more willing to recognize that fact, I think.
Maybe it comes from a general who gets applause, and academic he gets booed.
Maybe that's the answer.
Also, the sense is you threw out some statistics before about the number of that are in the armed forces, and as is pointed out in the book, a lot of it's intergenerational now, you know, or transgenerational. But 4% of the GDP goes to armed for the military, whereas it was 40% during that Second World War for military budget, and that's because we're doing a lot of things technologically now.
Well, that's right. I mean, technology has really intervened or been appropriated in a way that makes it possible to field a much smaller force in which any individual warrior is much more lethal on the battlefield or in the battle space just because of these advances in technology, especially the development of so-called smart weapons with very, very high accuracy rates. You compare the kinds of things like Hellfire missiles fired from the Predator drone to the gravity-dropped bombs in World War II, there's just simply no comparison. In World War II, on average, it took – I'm going to do this from memory, so I might not get it exactly right, but close enough. It took something like 100 and some sorties, dropping something like 650 bombs to be sure you've destroyed one single target. In the original initiative we took in Afghanistan in 2001, 134 airplanes destroyed 137 targets in one night. So the amplification of the power of accuracy in our weapon systems has just made the fighting force peculiarly and historically unprecedentedly lethal and effective. And from the strictly military point of view, that's a terrifically positive development. But it also underwrites the increasing diminution of the size of the armed force and its insulation from civil society at large.
And let's talk more about that insulation, because one could argue that war is no longer being waged for the citizens, for example. And I think in the book we're talking about, the modern American military, that is indeed perceived as the case now.
Well, I think, frankly, the composition of the force, the nature of the force that we have today, and we've had for 40 years since the onset of the all-volunteer force in 1973, creates a moral hazard for the political leadership, the president in particular, to make this fateful decision to use force as an instrument of national policy in the full knowledge that the society in whose name this force is being deployed will not be asked to break a sweat when it does so. It won't be taxed. It won't put very many of its sons and daughters in harm's way. And no one is in the force who is not there voluntarily in the first place. So it just creates a space for political decision making that opens up the possibility of abuse and bad decision making.
And that space is really a chasm between the military and the civilian population, which I think it's safe to say is widening.
I think that's right. I was an observer at a Army ROTC exercise at what was then still called Fort Lewis, Washington, about 5 years ago. And I heard several senior officers during the week that I was there ask the rhetorical question of me and of each other. I heard this a dozen times or more. How can it be – this is 2007, mind you – how can it be that the Army is at war and the country is not? And that question summed up what in their mind – the minds of these senior military officers, what the situation was, that the country paid little or no notice to the fact that the force was out there and suffering and dying in the field and was fighting in their name. Again, you contrast this with the Vietnam era when we had a draft army and when the citizenry – and it was also larger than the force we have today, and a lot of people were there involuntarily because of the draft. And war and the prospect of death focuses the mind like few other things do. And many, many American households were forced to think about that engagement in very, very direct ways. That's not the situation we have today.
And there was never anything – there's never been anything subsequent like the protests that we saw against the Vietnam War. I mean, Iraq, Afghanistan, any military movement.
I think that's absolutely right. The polls show that a majority of Americans soured on the Iraq War at some point and Afghanistan too to a certain extent. But the valence of that disenchantment doesn't bear any resemblance to what happened in the 1960s and early 70s in the Vietnam War, I think largely because the incidence of the burden of service simply does not fall on very many Americans today.
Talking with Professor David Kennedy, who's the editor of a new book called The Modern American Military. And it's not only that it's a different kind of army in terms of technology and more lethal and smarter and more inexpensive with all the modern technology and all these things that we've hit on already. But it's also changed enormously because of contractors and because of women.
Well, yes. At the height of the Iraq engagement, and the same thing is true in Afghanistan actually, this is an astounding fact it seems to me, but there were more civilian contractors in the field, in theater, in the country than there were uniformed military personnel. And that raises all kinds of questions about the perception in the public at large about just how big a force has been committed, because it's easier to hide or mask or ignore contractors than it is uniformed people. And of course, it raises all kinds of questions about the integrity of the command and control structure when it comes to controlling the behavior of contractors as opposed to people in the traditional chain of command. So this, again, is unprecedented. It's outsourcing in the military domain in a way that we've just had very little historical experience with until quite recently.
And without conscription, again, it brings up the question of ownership. The government's pretty free to engage, certainly not necessarily have to worry about protest or any kind of recriminations along those lines?
Well, much less so. And in fact, if you go back to the origins of the all-volunteer force in 1973, it actually – the idea began – it was born in the Nixon presidential campaign in 1968 when he was casting about for some way to quell campus protests against the Vietnam War and citizen protests against the Vietnam War. And part of the whole idea behind the creation of the all-volunteer force was that it would not only in the immediate instance of Vietnam in the late 60s and early 70s, but long term, it would serve to insulate the public from the use of the force, and it would thereby make it easier to do so. So this is part of the logic of the all-volunteer force from the outset.
So also an essay in your collection by Jonathan Shea where he essentially argues that there's inadequate attention as a result of the volunteer armed forces and the changes that have accrued that we're talking about here. Not only, of course, perhaps one could argue to the increasing number of disabilities and but moral wounds he uses as well.
Yeah. Well, the book, I might say, and Shea's essay is exemplary of this, is about a lot of things. It's about battlefield medicine. It's about the role of gender issues in the military. It's about budgeting issues. It's about the demography of the force, about the strategic and tactical doctrines that are relevant to the force. Shea's essay is, fittingly enough, I think, the concluding essay in the book, and it's about what happens to people when they come home from war principally. And he does use the phrase moral wounds. And in his argument, part of the problem, the core of the problem, is that troops today in the kinds of military engagements in which we are engaged are asked to do things that traditionally armed forces were not officially asked to do. For example, he gives an example of a Marine sniper who came back from the war and he had been in a battle situation where his unit was pinned down by an Iraqi sniper, and he was asked to come forward, identify the Iraqi sniper and eliminate him because he was killing people in the Marine unit. So this young Marine sniper takes position. He finds the Iraqi sniper and he prepares to take his shot. And as he's about to squeeze the trigger, he sees that the Iraqi has an infant baby strapped to his chest. And that's the situation he faces. Need he fire or not? He did fire, sees the round kill both the infant and the sniper, and that's what he has to live with the rest of his life. And Shea argues that that kind of decision is just more – it happens more often in so-called counterinsurgency warfare, war amongst the people, than it did in traditional clashes on formal battlefields between uniformed forces on both sides. And so that was bad enough, believe me, but that there's more of this kind of engagement with deep moral ambiguity and conflict in it than there once was.
The whole question also about political accountability for missions or for war activity of any kind – brings up also the role of commander-in-chief. I mean, in a sense, we had a program with Gary Wills who was questioning the whole nature of how the interpretation of really the commanding power of commander-in-chief ought to be seen in light of actual constitutional responsibilities and the like. But presidents have become, as Wills argues, more powerful, and they become more powerful in terms of dictating policy. More powerful as a result of what happened after 1973, haven't they?
Well, you bet. And here's again a startling number, I think, that really illustrates the point. In the era of the all-volunteer force – pardon me, of the conscript force that we had from the end of World War II down to 1973, it embraces the Korean and Vietnam Wars and some other actions. But in that entire period when the force was a conscript force, there were 19 foreign interventions by the military. In the 40 years since we've had the all-volunteer force, there have been 146 foreign interventions. So just on the face of it, the difference in those two numbers, you can drill down and refine it a little bit. But just on the face of it, it suggests a very different political situation when it comes to the decision to shoulder arms. And it's easier in the era of the all-volunteer force than it was in the era of the conscript force.
Again, our guest is David M. Kennedy. And by the way, he'll be at Kepler's tomorrow at 7:30. He's with us now talking about the modern American military and many of the changes that have occurred, particularly since the Volunteer Army of 1973. I'm going to invite listeners to join us now. And in fact, we welcome your phone calls and your involvement in the program if you have questions or comments, particularly some of you who are in the armed forces or who have family in the armed forces may want to join us and talk about this ongoing problem of the separation between those of us who are civilians and the military in terms of a chasm that a number of those who are part of this book have commented on. You may want to comment as well. We welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number available right now is 866-733-6786. And again, we do welcome your phone call, so feel free to join us in the conversation. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. So this is the whole question, David, about who serves. I mean, like you said before, when there was a draft, anybody could get drafted. There was always arguments that, you know, poor people were more subject. You could get an academic deferment and all that sort of thing. And there were all these arguments about people of color serving more in Vietnam, which I think can be substantiated. But now there's a whole different attitude because, you know, somebody signs up, they sign up. And I mean, the socioeconomic stretch of that has just completely gone through a whole spin.
Well, that's right. People of the 1.4 million people in the active duty force today, they don't all serve for the same reasons. They have a lot of different motives. Many of them are highly idealistic and patriotic in ways that deserve our respect. But on balance, the force is disproportionately recruited from some of the least advantaged sectors in our society. In fact, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, when he gave a speech about now a little over a year ago at Duke University, he said out loud for the first time from the mouth of the defense secretary, in my understanding, he specified it. He said, we are disproportionately recruiting this force from the southern and the Rocky Mountain states and, in fact, from the most rural districts of the South and the Rocky Mountain states. And recruitments from cities, especially on the two coasts, are disproportionately way below what the demographic evidence would suggest on the face of it, should be their proportionate representation. So this is now pretty well documented. And I do think this is just a personal opinion of mine, but I do think that much of the deference that we all feel and witness being paid to uniformed people today in airports and train stations and buses and wherever you see them is fueled not only by respect for who they are and what they do, but by guilt that the rest of us at large are not really required in any way to share the risk of this kind of service. And we feel a certain kind of guilt-ridden obligation to those who do.
We alluded also to how intergenerational this has become in terms of those who serve in the armed forces or who volunteer to serve in the armed forces now. And there's really a danger here of creating a military caste system almost.
Yeah. Again, going back to that experience I had at Fort Lewis, Washington a few years ago, at that time, the Army, just the one branch of service, had conducted a survey of its general officers, brigadier general and above. And at that time, there were 307 brigadier and above general officers in the United States Army. And one of the results of the survey was that they had discovered, and they were themselves rather amazed at this number, those 307 generals had 180 of their children in service. And they referred to this with a mixture of both pride and, I must say, not trivial anxiety as the family business. Because what they understood they were witnessing is the evolution, the creation of an intergenerational, self-perpetuating military caste, precisely the kind of problem associated with standing armies that the founders were very, very worried about when they formed militias instead of long-term standing armies of a large scale. So I was so arrested by that number, 307 general officers in the United States Army with 180 children in service, that when I came back to campus at Stanford, a research assistant and I tried to figure out how many children of the 535 elected members of the United States Congress, 100 in the Senate, 435 in the House, how many of their children were in service. And our methodology was a little flaky, I have to say, because it's hard to really generate the number. But the best we could come up with was that those 535 federal elected representatives had 10 of their children in service. So again, the contrast in those numbers is pretty worrisome, that the 307 generals with 180 children in service, 535 elected officials with 10 children in service.
A lot of things you point out, and that those who contributed to this book that you've edited point out, are very worrisome. It's also, I want to get to our callers here and bring our listeners into this, but this change toward more technology and the shape of the military being more and more technological. Now we've got surveillance drones that have been released by the Chinese over Japan. They're finding out more and more about this. Some of it's stolen, of course, but how we do drone, how we use drones, and they're monitoring the East China Sea. They're doing it in the Western Pacific. I mean, if anything, there's a kind of a race going on here in terms of who can be the more technological when you bring in the Chinese to the equation.
Well, yeah, you know, if you think this through to its logical or maybe crazy conclusion, it's not that difficult to envision a world in which that was depicted in those Terminator movies.
Exactly.
Where it's Skynet becomes this self-perpetuating, fully automated and non-human force out there in the world or in the universe that's doing it or the galaxy is doing whatever it's doing. That was once rather fantastic science fiction, but it looks increasingly plausible as we go forward. And we've yet to see, to my knowledge, an instance where the military doesn't like to call these things drones. They refer to them as remotely piloted aircraft because they are piloted. There are human pilots in control. And that's a safety measure to have human pilots in the equation. But it's not all that difficult to imagine. One of these things could go rogue. It could escape somehow its control system. The pilot loses control and it inflicts
There was one that was actually taken by the Iranians, you may recall, that actually landed somehow in Iran. And it was a very sophisticated drone, let's call it what I think it should
be. Well, it is the popular and customary term. It's just the military resists it for the obvious reason.
Well, I'm not going to resist calls. We've got a lot of them. Let me go to Felicia. You're our first caller. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was in the Air Force from 95 to 2003, deployed once as an airman, deployed twice for Central Command as a contractor, and then when I got out, I started taking some classes. I took an American history class, and we brought up the draft, and I said everybody should be drafted, both men and women, and all the young people looked at me as if I had, like, three heads and like I was evil. And I said, y'all don't know what's going on. I was like, there are people dying. There are people coming back psychologically messed up. I came back with intense depression. I was like, y'all aren't stakeholders. If you were all stakeholders, we would see protests in the street like we did in the 70s and 60s and 70s. But y'all are oblivious. And that's the problem. If we're not stakeholders, no one will ever lift a finger or say anything or do anything because it's not them. And I was one of those families who, like, went back generational of people who were in the military. And as far as drones, we are building autonomous drones. So.
Well, Felicia, I appreciate hearing from you. I'd like to get a response from Professor Kennedy on that. Should we go back to the draft, David?
Well, I like the term stakeholders. In several of the authors in this collection, this book of mine, use the term skin in the game, which connotes the same idea, that we need to somehow think about ways to connect civil society to the military, and especially to nurture civic engagement with the decision to shoulder arms. Do we need a draft? I'm not prepared to go that far. We need something that engages the citizenry with the military. But we wouldn't know what to do with a draft army on the scale of the World War II force today. It would be far too large for any strategic purpose that we can envision.
We'll continue with David Kennedy, new book, The Modern American Military, and your calls and emails. Again, you can also post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, one of this nation's leading historians, David Kennedy, with us this hour talking about a new book he's edited called The Modern American Military. And this year marks the 40th anniversary of America's all-volunteer force. How did the elimination of the draft affect the military? We are talking about how our U.S. society as a whole, also talking about, and the impact of technology on modern warfare, and how will having women in combat change the armed forces? These are some of the questions that we're examining and that are examined in the new book, The Modern American Military, edited by Pulitzer Prize-winning Stanford professor David Kennedy, who is Donald J. McLaughlin, Professor of History Emeritus, and also the editor of the book. And he'll be speaking and signing books tomorrow, September 24th at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30. And you can join us in conversation here. Our toll-free number, let me remind you, is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls or your emails. And the email address is forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Let me go to more calls. Kim is joining us from Novato. Hi, Kim.
Hi. So I just wanted to say that my fiance is serving in Afghanistan right now. Sorry, and his base was actually infiltrated 2 weeks ago, and it's a NATO base, and it actually didn't get very much news coverage, and I just feel like there's a lot of stuff still going on in Afghanistan, but we don't hear about it so much, and people think, oh, when we're not hearing about stuff that's going on in Afghanistan, everything must be okay, but it's definitely not, and I just wanted to hear what you guys thought about
it. I think that's an important point, don't you, David Kennedy? I mean, if it's... If people don't have the stake, as you said, they're not the stakeholders, then the media is going to reflect that.
Well, that's right. Unfortunately, and I underscore the word unfortunately, I really believe this, it becomes old news. And it's news of the war becomes old news, whereas historically war news is some of the most urgent and hot news there is. But when these conflicts are not only far away, but in which so few Americans really have skin in the game in any directly felt way, it's easy for the media simply to pass over this and ignore it. There's another dimension of this, if I can just dilate a little bit on this, that has to do with advances in battlefield medicine. Let's just take Iraq as the example. There's roughly 4,500 Americans killed in Iraq over the course of that engagement. It's the authors of my book, a couple of them, estimate that if we had the same battlefield medicine techniques and practices in place in Iraq as we had in Vietnam, which historically speaking isn't all that long ago, but if we did things the same way as in Iraq as we had in Vietnam, there would have been somewhere between 20 and 25,000 American dead in Iraq. Instead, there's fewer than 5,000.
We're saving more lives, but more men coming back and women coming back wounded.
There are several implications. Yeah. That's one big one for the people involved, that we've substituted lifelong living with bad trauma of one kind or another for mortality. And that's a burden on the individuals and on our society going forward that we may or may not honor in a proper fashion. But I want to emphasize the political point in this because I put it this way. Mortality is loud. The media must take notice of mortality. 25,000 deaths would have been a very big media story. 4,500 media deaths is a much smaller story, and it's harder to convey the individual stories of all the brutally traumatized troops who have survived IED explosions and so on and so forth. So all honor to the medical people for improving battlefield medicine techniques. But the unforeseen political implication of that is that it's among the many ways in which the larger society is less attuned to what's actually going on the battlefield.
Let me thank Kim for the call. Thank you, Kim. And let me go to more of your calls. John is with us next. John, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. A pleasure to be speaking with two thought leaders. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy, for your work. I read several of your books. Sorry to chase. My original question was more as to how the United States military has adapted and evolved with the development of insurgent warfare, especially considering our own guerrilla roots. But that's something I think more fundamental and pertinent to the discussion I wanted to bring up was the response to the Syrian chemical attack on the outskirts of Damascus. You know, David Cameron, you know, recalled the entire parliament from summer break and had a vote stood down his initial, you know, claims of unilateral military action. While our president said, I'm conferring with, you know, the same Senate intelligence foreign relations and intelligence committees that couldn't oversee the NSA, you know, warrantless wiretap programs. And I'm just baffled. I am amazed that there was not a single senator or congressman in response to that who was willing to at least speak about or craft a bill that would have restored the power of the purse to the Congress. I mean, are they so politically afraid of taking a stand one way or another that they've abdicated the responsibility of war to the executive?
David Kennedy.
Well, look, the urgent issue in front of us obviously is Syria, and the decision that may or may not get made in the near future about what we as a country are going to do about it. But let me just try to put this in a little bit of longer-term historical context or framework. As you probably know, John, the Constitution divides the responsibility for waging war and military decisions between the Congress and the President. Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 11 says that the Congress has the power to declare war. Article 2 designates the President as the Commander-in-Chief. And as has long been observed, that division of responsibility blurs the lines of accountability for who actually takes the initiative and so on, who has ultimate responsibility for warfare. And a famous constitutional scholar named Edwin Corbin once said that that constitutional arrangement was, from the outset, an invitation to conflict. Invitation to conflict is his phrase. Here's one of the – again, I'll give you some numbers. One of the really fascinating implications of this. The Constitution lodges the responsibility to declare war with the Congress. That's Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 11. You might think for a moment, how many times has the Congress of the United States exercised that constitutional responsibility over the 200 and some years of the history of the Republic? The answer is five. War of 1812, the Mexican War, Spanish-American War, World Wars I and II. Five times. The Congressional Research Service about a year or two ago did a study of how many overseas deployments of troops there have been since 1789, adoption of the Constitution, and the answer was over 300. So again, contrasting five formal declarations of war and 300 and some deployments suggests that not just in the case of Syria, but for the long term, historically, we are in the presence here of a woefully deficient constitutional mechanism for engaging, for utilizing deliberative processes of the kind that democracies are supposed to value in this most fateful of all decisions, which is the decision to wage war. We just don't have a good way to do it. Never have had.
In fact, let's talk about Syria for just a moment, because if indeed the decision had been made by President Obama to move towards some kind of military intervention, there was always this promise, at least, no boots on the ground. And the same was said about Libya. So now we're talking about a volunteer force that the president can say will be protected under the shield of no boots on the ground, at the same time that the president's making the decision whether or not we should engage technologically. Or whatever way, other than
boots
on the ground.
Well, actually, the president has, and one can have different views about this, but President Obama has, in fact, he's in the process of deferring to the Congress and giving it an opportunity to take voice and to honor its constitutional responsibilities to be a participant in this kind of decision.
But he also said, I have the option, and he made that very clear.
Well, of course. No president wants to totally renounce his freedom of action, his scope of discretion in this kind of thing. But the War Powers Act of 1973, passed in the wake of the Vietnam episode, tried to reassert the power of Congress to play an active role in the decision to wage war. And it requires the president, among other things, within 60 days of a deployment to come to Congress and get a formal resolution of approval for the action or end it. The War Powers Act of 1973 passed over Richard Nixon's veto. And no president since has honored its constitutional standing. It's never been tested in the courts. But every president has refused to accede to its terms, saying that I as president, need the discretion and freedom of action of Commander-in-Chief. There was a revisitation of the War Powers Act by a commission co-chaired by former Secretaries of State James Baker, Republican, and Warren Christopher, a Democrat, reported about 2 or 3 years ago now. And they recommended that the War Powers Act be revised so that the president had to come to Congress before a deployment and at least seek some kind of provisional or qualified approval, not after the fact but before the fact. Now, President Obama has not explicitly cited that recommendation by the Baker-Christopher Commission, but in fact that's what he's doing. He's trying to reverse the sequence of action, as it were, and make the Congress a participant in the decision going forward. That limits his freedom of action. But also, if it's successful, it gives broader legitimacy to the action if taken, and it makes the Congress a collaborator in the decision. So in some – the Congress is our most deliberative body. That's what it's all about, is our most representative body. It's 535 people there representing our interests, supposedly, not just the single person of the president. So in the abstract, I for one think this is a welcome way to proceed. But in actual reality, whether it happens this way or not, and whether in every possible imaginable instance this is the best way to proceed is another matter.
I also wonder how much the president was influenced by David Cameron and his decision to move to Parliament and then actually say no. Parliament says no, then I say no, even though he had been in favor of something before that. But just speculating, probably. Jeffrey tweets, it's not an all-volunteer force. There is a draft, and it's called the economy. Another email here from a listener named Michael who says, it is clear that the current composition of the U.S. military has been redesigned purposefully in great part as a large-scale missionary force by Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz as a for-profit concern. Call it the Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz doctrine. And a listener asks, the world no longer entertains the notion that Americans have moral high ground or even the military expertise or might to lead the free world. It has become obvious to everyone that the U.S. military actions are ruled by a chaotic array of conflicting interests with only two consistent results, incompetence and injustice. That's more of a statement. Actually, this is the question. Let me one more email. David, I wonder how you see the National Guard in today's military. When I was covering the war in Iraq and its consequences at home, I concentrated on the Guard because it seemed to me that it was more embedded in communities than regular forces.
Well, that's let me take the question about the National Guard. It's a very interesting point. Go back again to the 1970s, the inception of the all-volunteer force. Also, same year, War Powers Act is passed. So we see a convergence of schemes, plans, instruments that try to restrain the power of the president to wage war on his own hook. And among the things that evolved out of that was something that was the creation principally of an army general by the name of Creighton Abrams, who had been the U.S. commander in Vietnam. He was a World War II tanker, and he was the chairman of the – he was the Army Chief of Staff in the Nixon era. And he was the principal architect of something called the Total Force Doctrine, capital T, capital F, capital D, which comes into being in the 1970s just as the all-volunteer force being created. And his core concept was to redefine the reserves from a strategic reserve to an operational reserve. What that means in military terms is instead of the reserve being conceived of as an additional force that you can call into the battle space to add power to your punch at the critical moment, and that's the strategic reserve, it becomes an operational reserve which must be deployed simultaneously with the active force from the outset of the deployment for any anticipated large-scale long-term deployment. Now, what's the logic of this politically? It was exactly what you're talking about, that it would compel the mobilization of the reserves and the guard in quantity in order to make possible an active duty force deployment. This would be disruptive of many, many communities and would therefore raise the bar for presidential demonstration of a real national security threat to justify the action in question. You break that link between all those communities in which reservists and National Guards people serve, break that link and confine the action entirely to the active duty force. There is less burden placed upon civil society and upon those communities. They're exempt from contributions to this effort. This is the logic of Donald Rumsfeld's policy of creating this leaner, tighter, faster force. He called it rebalancing. The rebalancing doctrine when Rumsfeld was secretary was explicitly designed to put the last nail in the coffin of the so-called total force doctrine and make possible the deployment of the active duty force without summoning the reserves in any large numbers.
David Kennedy, our guest, his new book, The Modern American Military, and another caller joining us. Noah, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question involves, since such a sliver of the population actually serves, does that leave civilian policymakers, foreign policy establishment, and a press charged with asking the tough questions and demanding the answers from politicians? Had they had that experience, do you think they'd be more able or forced to actually communicate battlefield realities, discuss strategy and tactics with the American population, rather than falling back on the cliches of, say, isolationism, appeasement, and, America's call for higher purpose? And really, when the war drums for Syria were beating very loudly, the president and the advocates spoke of a sanitized and riskless campaign that they didn't even describe as war. So now it's, we don't even define war as war. So, you know, if you could just speak to that a bit, I'll take my answers off air.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Well, I think there are two things at issue in what you're saying, Noah, that we now fight a kind of sanitized war. That's partly true. We still have a lot of people killed and badly injured in the battle space in different places. But to an increasing degree, you're absolutely right. We fight by means of predator drones and remotely stealth aircraft that stand off in the battle space and launch missiles from 100 miles away and so on. So, yeah, that has a certain sanitizing effect, to be sure. But there are other issues here that have to do with just the numbers of people who serve and how much of that military experience gets translated back into the political system, you might say. As late as 1975, over 70% of the members of the United States Congress had some military experience. They'd either served active duty or a National Guard unit or a reserve unit or whatever. And whatever we might think about that in general, it gave them some kind of felt experience and memory of what warfare was all about at some level or other that they could bring to the moment when they had to participate in the decision whether or not to authorize the use of force. In today's Congress, fewer than 20% of the 535 members of the Congress have had any military experience. So there's just – I mean, to put it in the simplest and crudest terms, people know less about what they're talking about when they have to talk about going to war because 80% of them had no direct personal experience with that particularly brutal piece of human life.
Here's a veteran who writes, as a veteran, I'm torn. On the one hand, I want to support our troops, but on the other, I feel absolutely no commonality of purpose with them. The adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan are every bit as ill-advised and illegitimate as ours in Vietnam was. Further, I'm heartbroken that the peace movement has become almost completely passive. I went out wearing an old peace button just the other day, and a young woman in a local coffeehouse asked me what it meant. Bradley writes, we have seen how the likes of Halliburton and countless silent war industrialists have and continue to make truly stunning profits from the business of war. Please ask your guest his opinion of how profit and money-making might be fitting into the mercenary military and the philosophical perils therein. Are there lessons to be learned from the Prussians? Or maybe the Hessians, maybe more. Yeah, well, we talked about military contractors before, but It's hard to gauge, I imagine, isn't it, David Kennedy, how much this plays into the whole calculus of what we're talking about? I mean, in terms of furthering profits and the like.
Well, when Dwight Eisenhower in his last his farewell address sounded this now famous warning about the military-industrial complex and how this really troublesome nexus between for-profit corporations and the military establishment could create a permanent war-making class, you might say. At that time, the Pentagon budget was probably something better than 50% of the federal budget, and it was in the range of 8 to 10% of GDP. So in that context, that was a real worry. Today, military spending is huge. It's $700 billion a year, but it's only about 4% of GDP, of gross domestic product. So it actually has a smaller incidence in the economy at large. So in some ways, Eisenhower's warning about the industrial-military complex has a little different feel to it today. We're talking about a smaller part of the whole economy. And this worries some people, we're talking about fewer corporations. It's not as deep and widespread a business of military contracting as it used to be. And some people even worry that there are now so relatively few military contractors that if one or two or three or four of them go out of business, we will lack the means within the United States to make our own munitions, which is probably not going to happen in the near term, but that Eisenhower probably could not have envisioned that. Can I go back to the veterans comment?
Sure, but just a quick question before I get you back to the veterans comment. A listener says we're using contractors in place of troops, and do we know the number of contractor casualties? It conveniently doesn't seem to be factored in.
That's a very good question. I do not know the answer to that. Some contractor casualties, of course, are quite famous, as in those Blackwater people in Fallujah. But I don't know the numbers. And I'm not – off the top of my head, I'm not sure who does, if anybody does. And to the extent that's true, it's another example of how these contractors operate outside the normal military accountability.
A lot
system.
Of them offer, operate cloak and dagger too, don't they?
That's right.
So it's really hard to get some kind of. But you go back to the veterans comment.
Well, I resonated especially to the comment that the caller supports the troops, but feels completely disconnected from the purposes for which the troops are being deployed. And this goes back to something that has been with us now for at least a decade or more than a decade about the political summons to support the troops, which has always struck me as a really peculiar thing to say. I mean, who doesn't support the troops as individuals who are bearing this terrible burden and being asked to do awful things? It's both psychologically and politically, I think, just impossible to say, I don't support the troops. I hope they all die. I hope they're all killed in the battlefield. Nobody's going to say that.
I'm going to go back to all that, a lot of it urban legendary stuff about Vietnam soldiers coming back and being spat upon. And
to my understanding, that is urban legend, that there's not a single documented case of a Vietnam vet returning being spat upon. But whether that's literally the case or not, there's another matter at issue here is what I want to get at. In the Vietnam era, the armed forces as an institution and individual soldiers became the objects of popular wrath and disenchantment with the Vietnam War. That's not true today. Whatever degree of disillusion or disenchantment or opposition there is to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the actual military personnel and the military as an institution enjoy unprecedented, virtually unprecedented respect in our culture at large. And this actually, there's a broader context to this. We have really excellent polling data going back into the 1950s even, about how the public at large regards various institutions in our society. The military, the Congress, the media, the courts, professional athletes, you name it, popular culture, all kinds of things. Almost without exception, as a people today, the American people have far less respect and regard for most of the major institutions in this society. There's really a pervasive crisis of authority and legitimacy in our major institutions. The one hugely conspicuous exception to that is the military. The military shows up in these polls consistently as the one single institution that people still have great respect for. Now, all honor to the military for having commanded that respect. I'm not going to argue with that at all. But I would just make the observation that history suggests that societies in which all institutions have lost major legitimacy except the generals are societies that usually have problems with the continuing operation of their democratically elected political systems.
Sean writes, I'd like to hear some discussion on how we might create a draft that allows for multiple ways to serve, for example, Peace Corps, Diplomatic Corps, State Department, and military branch. And sort of dovetailing with that, another listener, Mark from San Carlos, says, well, I recognize that the problems David Kennedy points out are real. He's been around this long enough to offer a few suggestions on how to reduce the problems. Just pointing out problems is the easy part. Well, so he says. But anyway, have you thought about – I mean, a historian's role is not necessarily come up with solutions, but the other listener says maybe we could extend the draft to include diplomatic service, that sort of thing.
Well, one of my contributors in this volume on the modern American military is retired Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry, as former U.S. commander in Afghanistan, also former ambassador to Afghanistan. He and I wrote a piece in the New York Times on Memorial Day last May in which we did try to address some possible solutions to this problem, the problem being the disconnect between civil society and the military. A full-out draft was not part of the solution that we embraced. We suggested a little bit tentatively, to be honest, but we suggested maybe some kind of a lottery draft where it would be understood that very few people would actually ever be forcibly conscripted, but that for a period of 1 or 2 years in a young person's life, male or female, they would be subject to the possibility that if volunteer recruitments fell short, that their lottery number might come up. And that would have the effect of making people think about the prospect of military, involuntary military service for a certain formative period in their lives. So that's maybe a kind of soft core solution, but there it is. Another one, which I think has actually a little more bite potentially, is to pass a statute that says that when the Congress agrees, as it did in the Iraq resolution for the use of force, for example, or the Tonkin Gulf resolution to go back further, when the Congress agrees to affirm the president's action in taking to resort to military force, it must simultaneously provide for funding of that initiative. So you tax upfront. And again, the burden of taxation then is felt out there in the society at large. People know that they have skin in the game because they see it in their tax bill. And again, it's a mechanism, the paying upfront for wars, will, I think, better engage the attention of the citizenry.
Our guest again is David Kennedy, his new book, The Modern American Military, and our next caller is Phil. Good morning, Phil.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for this program. In the last few years, I read an article in one of the popular magazines that criticized the American military for the lack of disciplining general officers. In World War II, which was a 4.5 to 5 years, something like 5 to 15 general officers were fired because of incompetence. But here we've been in two wars for 10 years each, over 10 years each, and not one single general has been fired. And another thesis of this article was that the promotion system in the military is so regimented now that people just do what they have to get their next promotion, that there's no Eisenhower, no George Marshall out there who's willing to stand up and take a stand against the current thread of military thought and introduce new ideas. So I wonder if professor could respond to those two theses of that article. I don't remember the author of the article, but I also... Okay,
let me jump in because we got seconds left. David Kennedy.
Well, I think you're probably referring to a book, and there was articles associated by Tom Ricks called The Generals, which makes exactly this point. And just a factual matter, at least one general has been canned, Stanley McChrystal. So it's not 100% true that no general has been dismissed.
The book, again, The Modern American Military. On the cover, you see a drone on top and you see women lifting arms on the bottom.
They're Lady Marines.
Lady Marines, perfect cover. Again, 7:30 tomorrow, you can meet the author, or the editor, the professor at Kepler's down in the South Bay. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
That's in Menlo Park. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for being with us this hour of Forum. We look forward to more tomorrow. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.